Here I have given three sections from the rule, the prologue, or at least a selection from the prologue, chapter 1, of course, which describes the different kinds of monks, and then chapter 72 on the good zeal. And I think these are three fundamental texts from the rule that are important for us to ponder in light of the sources we've been looking at and in light of the themes of the interrelationship between community and solitude. Beginning with the prologue, notice that the call comes from God. The call is an invitation into dialogue, into relationship. And then as you drop down towards the end of the prologue, how does Benedict describe the way of holiness for which he's legislating? It is a Dominici Schola Servizii. It is a school of the Lord's service, a place where, and what does school mean? It doesn't just mean academic place. We in English still have resonances of what this schola means when we think of the place where people chant together. The schola is where voices blend in the praise of God. The school of fish, for example, we still have in English, means those who are moving together, those creatures that are moving together with one another towards a goal. We are moving together. And as we move together in this schola of the Lord's service, he says, our hearts expand, dilatato corde. Our hearts open wide with as we run with unspeakable sweetness of love on the path of God's commandments. And this running is a running in community in Benedict's vision. We are running together, and we'll see this particularly at the end of chapter 72. If we drop down now to chapter 1, where he does describe the different kinds of monks, it's important for us to bear in mind that Benedict is borrowing on an ancient model. He's inherited it immediately from the rule of the master, but the master himself inherits it both from Cassian and from Jerome, where the description of the good kind of monk is seen as something that you do in contrast to the bad kind of monk. You have those who live in obedience to an abbot, the Cenobites, and then you have the Sarabites, who are those who follow their own will, who do exactly what they want to do. They do not have an abbot. They are not able to live out obedience. You have the Cenobites, who are living stability, who are living a life of commitment to a particular place. And then in contrast with them, in Benedict's rule, you have the gyrovagues, the false monks who are false because they wander. They do not have stability. They are not fixed. But this is the place, too, where Benedict, using, again, this classical and inherited terminology, describes the hermit life. And this really is the only place in the rule where he describes the possibility of a hermitage, of a moving into the hermit life after one is no longer in the first fervor, after one has undergone long testing in the monastery, being trained to fight against the devil through, as he puts it, the help and training of many others. So there is a preparation in the Cenobium, in this model that Benedict recommends, and even a very strong emphasis on the Cenobium, to the extent that we have to admit there is no mechanism in the rule by which one migrates or graduates up or moves out into the solitary life. It's here as a theoretical possibility, and it's something again that Benedict has inherited. He's not creating this himself. In this edition of the rule, I might add, in boldface type, you have the material that is unique to Benedict, the stuff that Benedict does not get from the rule of the master. And so what we've looked at before, this glorious vision of our hearts opening wide as we run on the way of God's commandment, that is unique to Benedict. That's his own stuff. But here, in this chapter, he's inherited all of this terminology from the master. He's not crafting or shaping it. He's transmitting a tradition he's received. And yet, in receiving it, one wonders the extent to which Benedict himself really envisions a significant hermit option in his own monastery. It's a very specific and interestingly debatable point, because, of course, he concludes at the end with a very fascinating phrase at the end of chapter 1. Let us then proceed with God's help to make provision for the Cenobites. And although I have translated it as strong kind, the truth is he uses the superlative, fortissimum genus. The strongest kind would be a literal translation, although it must be admitted that in the kind of Latin of Benedict's day, this kind of superlative language could sometimes be used not with that extreme degree of comparison. But he is using very strong language to describe the Cenobites. They are not second rate. They are not a school for beginners. The Cenobites are the strong and maybe even the strongest kind of the monks. And Benedict's whole rule is a rule for Cenobites. And we see this in particular in chapter 72, the last selection that I've given on the good zeal. This is what it looks like when Cenobitic life is lived out to its fullness. He describes the evil zeal of bitterness, the destructiveness, the murmuring, which he describes elsewhere, the detraction that leads to hell. It's this evil, addictive zeal which destroys those who use it. He describes it only to describe in detail its opposite, a good zeal that separates only from vice and leads to God and to life everlasting. And as we see, the way that it leads to God, the way that it leads to everlasting life, is through community. This zeal is practiced by monks with the most fervent love. And then, quoting St. Paul, how does this happen? Ut honore se invicem preveniant, that they should outdo one another in showing honor. This is very beautiful, almost contemplative language. The only outdoing that takes place in the monastery is my ability to honor you. I can honor you more greatly than anyone else. That's the form of competitiveness that can exist. I have the capacity to behold the glory of God in you, and that I have more greatly than you do. Therefore, we depend on one another to learn about who we truly are, and we grow insofar as we learn to show honor to one another. And then he describes in detail what this honoring consists in. To bear infirmities, whether of body or of character, literally of morals, whether we disapprove of the other person's way of life, to bear that, to carry the other person's infirmity, is part of this showing honor. Competing, he says, only in showing obedience, listening and doing for the other what is needful. None judging, none following what he judges most useful for himself, but what is better for another. Practicing fraternal love, fraternal charity. And in the conclusion of this beautiful passage, Benedict rings the changes of love. He tries to find all the words for love in the Latin language that he can. Amor, caritas, diligere. He's finding every word that he can in order to describe what it means to live in community, describing our charity towards one another, offering God this loving reverence, loving our abbot with sincerity and a humble affection, preferring nothing whatever to Christ, and this beautiful conclusion, may he bring us all together, pariter, ad vitam aeternam perducat. In Benedict's vision, monastic life and the salvation that is attained in monasticism is something that occurs together, pariter. We go together to God. Just as we pray together, just as we live together, we journey together in salvation to God. Salvation is not individualistic. It is God saving his people and the people gathered together by God, journeying together, helping one another, showing the face of God to one another, leading each other into the presence of God. This is Benedict's vision of what it means to live in community.